almost the same signal-to-noise ratio as using a real antenna. Receivers are amazingly forgiving. So almost any piece of wire will work, and the kinds of telephone wire goes out of the house reasonably high up, goes down the block, and so it's got a lot of capability, a lot of wire in the air, and therefore it's got to work. As Hal said, to use capacitive coupling, in other words, let me pick a number, 100 picofarads, the ceramic capacitor between that wire and your radio, just to be sure that any DC voltage on the wire is not coupled into your radio, is the safe thing to do. But you're only listening to the high frequency component, and the amount that goes through 100 picofarad to ceramic capacitor is all going to be there. 99% of it's going to be there, and the DC is removed. So it sort of has to work. Let me drop.
No, 0.001, not 100 time puff.
Tell me what's wrong with 100 puff. Over to you, Al.
Well, depending on the impedance of the receiver, he's not going to have very good coupling. A 001 should work pretty well to pass all the, the lowest reactance with a 001 give more chance of gain.
Rick, you have a comment?
Glenn recognized. 001 really is 1,000 picofarads. So Hal and I are discussing the merits of 100 picofarad versus 1,000 picofarad. They will all work. And I'm going to agree with Hal on this one. I think the 1,000 is going to work better. The one thing I worry about is that a phone line could contain other kinds of interference that are hard to deal with. So if you do experience that, and you've got the right kind of a noise blanker, maybe all's well. But a phone line could have all kinds of interference on it. Let's see if Glenn has ever done that. He's got opinions on that approach, on that problem. KC2QIQ, after waiting for the beeps.
Dick, he also asked about if you felt there was any danger involved, just to...
No, I think the worst you've got on the phone line is 48 volts, and a 001 capacitor that Hal's recommending, as long as it's got a 48-volt rating, it's not dangerous. And the 48 volts on the phone line, the current capability, I'm reasonably sure, is below shock capability. The number of milliamps it can dish, I think, is not enough to create electrocution. Let's see what Glenn has. I wonder if you've ever used a phone line as a receiving antenna, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Vic. Good evening, everybody on the net tonight. I was just listening to this, and it's something I really would advise for a lot of reasons. The first one is that there's a ring on POTS lines, not digital lines, but on POTS lines, the old wired copper twisted lead that ran up to the pole, have a ring function. And if you have a ring that ever takes place in that line, you have the capability of going to have an impulse of 300 volts. That the receiver's not going to be too happy with. Plus, there's other things, too, that the grounding standard, one side, it's still a 600 ohm line, one side is going to be tied to ground, which would be the safest, but probably the least amount of signal, and the other side would have some other possible input pulse noise, the Kaiser kilovolts. That's what the standard is. It has to be at least 1.5 keV. That's what the phone has got to be able to withstand. KC2QIQ, back to you, Dick.
According to the standard, these high impulse voltages that could take place, and the telephone has to tolerate that without damage. Any of the wires that we put, long wire antenna sticking in the backyard that we plug into our radio, is also capable of picking up a local lightning impulse, EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and so a reasonable design radio can tolerate a lot of that. By way of the coupling capacitor, the DC component doesn't get through, and so I'm not convinced that that is so dangerous, Glenn. And also, the line that is grounded, probably that is grounded way back at the central office, 1, 3, 5 miles away, and a piece of wire that many miles long, grounded that far away, I think is a darn good receiving antenna. What do you think on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2IW in the TechNet.
You can identify which side is your neutral side, which is the side that's coupled to the neutral wire of your household electric. If you look at your service when it enters the house, all utility lines, including telephone, cable vision, etc., all have to be tied to neutral upon the entry point when it comes into the house, and a ground rod has to be placed on the outside. Ground's a lot more local than you think. It's up to its code, your house. And here again, it's just I think with short wave, the hand put out a nice, you know, long wire out your window or something, it's going to be a lot less complicated and probably a lot cheaper for your recipient opinion, Dick. KTRI, that's KC2, join you.
Glenn, you're quite often in your occupation involved with safety standards of electrical systems. I'd like to believe that the wires of a twisted pair, plain old telephone system running at something like 48 volts negative, I'd like to believe the current capability there is well below the capability of the approximately 100 milliamps. At one time, we used to think 100 milliamps is potentially lethal as an electrical shock source. I'd like to believe the current capability of a plain old telephone system is below that lethality. Is that roughly true? KC2QI2, K2RIW.
I think from human safety, don't hear of too many people getting electrocuted by a telephone line. It's very unusual. Not impossible, but highly unusual. I think that standard for capacity on the old POTS lines, this is not talking about the new digital system, the POTS lines, they could handle as much as half an amp deck, so there's some good capacity there. The copper they used to use was, 24 and 20 gauge wire. KYWKC2QIQ.
But the way the telephone circuit works, the so-called pickup and whatever, there is a series resistor between you and that 48 volt power supply. And I'm going to guess that resistor is something like 1,000 ohms. And therefore, 48 milliamps is the maximum that could issue. Even though the wiring is capable of a lot of high current, the circuit source impedance is a hell of a lot lower than the wire impedance, is what I'd like to believe. Am I naive on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't think it's naive, Dick. I just think that, in a properly operating system, that's completely true. What about in its first volt? It's not true anymore. And how often do first-hand faults take place on telephone systems that are not even technically supported by the telephone company anymore? As far as the telephone company is concerned, they don't want to deal with POTS lines. They're just only allowing the service for POTS lines that are in existence, but I don't think you can get new ones. The chances of having things go awry on those twisted lines, I think today is probably greater than it ever had been, Dick. But here again, my view might be a little bit pessimistic, but I don't think I'd want to tie a receiver to a telephone line, a POTS line. Again, just an opinion, Dick. KTRIW, KC2QIQ.
6DPZ with a comment.
You got it, Hal.
If in doubt, after you put the capacitor to the antenna receiver, just take two diodes back to back, put them across the line, so 7/10 of a volt, it's going to all be there, so you won't do any damage to the receiver.
Yeah, that's a nice expedient. So let me draw a schematic of what Hal just said. Of course, there could be 48 volts approximately on the telephone twisted pair wires. You're going to have a 001 series capacitor on whichever wires that you use. Now, to make sure that there's no spikes of voltage that go beyond what the radio can tolerate, you take a pair of, say, silicon diodes back-to-back, and so that you put them from the capacitor output into the radio. At that junction, capacitors, the pair of diodes back-to-back, go to ground. Now, you never have more than 7/10 of a volt on that wire. These should be power diodes. And so, now, never more than 7/10 of a volt can get into the radio, even during impulses. It's a very nice, safe circuit. And so, as you can tell, we're getting various opinions on this. Not very many people have used telephone lines as an antenna. But by way of Hal's suggestions, I think we found ways of making it a hell of a lot safer. And when it comes to a receiving antenna, there's all kinds of wires that you bring, all kinds of wires that are in the house. And so quite a few of these experiments could be done. And some of them will work better than others, depending on the propagation, what frequency you're on, and so on. Antennas are fun to experiment with, as you can tell. KC2WGB with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just one other comment. During ring is 300 volts, 10 ohms. So an active ringing POTS line will have an impulse of 300 volts in order to activate the ring function. QIQ.
in which case the back-to-back diodes, I think, would give protection. The 001 capacitor and the back-to-back diodes, I think, is going to give quite a bit of protection. The ring circuit, I'm guessing, is at something like 90 hertz, or is it 50 hertz, 20 hertz? And so through the 001 capacitor, that lower frequency is essentially an open circuit, and the diodes will protect you. Say what you think on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
As I said, I think it'll probably work in theory, but here again, why hook your receiver up to it when you're sure you just hang a nice wire out the window? Just my opinion, Dick. Sorry to interfere. KC2QIQ.
No apology required, Glenn. You're not interfering. You're giving another opinion. And so there is no one exact answer on any of this. And so we want to hear all the opinions. And that way the person can gather all those opinions, decide for himself which ones are relevant to his particular environment. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
DH for the question?
I mean, John. Who's the person with the question? Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is WA2VDH again. Yeah, I was just wondering, are we talking about an active POTS line? Is this an active telephone?
An abandoned line.
Yeah, John, we were told it's an abandoned line. In theory, it's just sitting there going nowhere. But Glenn is telling us, in the worst case, if it's hooked up to the central office and it's got a potential ring circuit on it, I mean, for somebody to ring a circuit that has been abandoned, I think, is very rare. But Glenn is looking at the worst possible case. The 48 volts that's there, if it's active, the ring circuit of higher voltage yet, I think it's 20 hertz, is the ring circuit. I think you're going to be protected by that 001 capacitor and the back-to-back diodes. So it was told to us, once again, as an abandoned circuit. See if you have any further questions or comments on that, John. The B2VDH, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Okay, because if it's an active circuit, the back-to-back diodes would take it off hook and make it look like somebody picked up the phone. But, it is very possible that even if it's abandoned, with all the things happening at the cross-connect bay there, somebody could dump a ringing voltage, which I think is 90 volts, 20 hertz or something like that. But it'll give you a good jolt, I mean, if you do get across it. I remember hooking up several illegal phones back in the dark ages of the 70s. Hi. Back to net.
It's DPZ with a comment.
John, you may have missed the fact that we are recommending, before the wire is connected to the receiver, a 001 series capacitor be used first into the back-to-back diodes. I think the capacitor is such that you will no longer pick up that line. See if you agree with that one, John. W2VDH, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
DPZ has a comment.
That'll prevent the line from going off hook, but those big jumps of ringing voltage, if ringing does get on there, those big transients might get through that capacitor as big jumps into the antenna circuit of the receiver.
I think that ringing circuit is a sine wave. K6TPZ, wait for the beeps. K2LIW, go ahead, Al.
Okay, it's K6DPZ. I just want to say, years ago, when they had regular telephones, not all this modern stuff, if a phone company would be able to determine if there's somebody that's put a phone on the line by looking at the capacitance of the line of the ringer. So the way, at least I was to get away with it many years ago, is you use a diode on the line in series with each phone with a cap across it, and then it rings only on a half cycle. Phone company doesn't realize there's two phones. Go ahead, pick it up, Dick.
Okay, so the two phones were hooked up with two separate diodes. One diode is getting the positive sine wave, the other diode is getting the negative sine wave, is what I think you're saying, Al. And the ringers were happy getting only half the voltage, they would still ring. I'm filling in the words you didn't give. Am I correct there, Hal? K6DPZ, K2LIW?
Correct. So they couldn't really see. They saw, you know, the ringers didn't show up. That's how they would know there's another phone on the line. You just put a dial up series with the ringer and go down the road.
And the possibility exists that there's a hell of a lot of tails of a phone company measuring capacitance on the line, trying to make a guess as to how many phones are in that particular house. Would they be doing that at the utility pole out in front of the house with some kind of a fancy capacitor sensor? I am guessing you could not do that back at the central office after a few miles of wire. I don't think you can very accurately measure capacitance anymore. That's a guess on my part, Hal. K6DPZ, K2LAW, the tech man.
Go to central office. You're able to see if there are two on the line, but when you use the diodes, they only really looked at it, they really couldn't tell, you know, if there were two ringers on the line.
Well, let's get specific here. Each individual plain old telephone, Ma Bell system, presents a certain amount of capacitance and or inductance of that ringing circuit. How many microfarads or picofarads of capacitance is a telephone? And when you've got 3 miles of twisted pair wiring, measuring capacitance through that wire, the wiring might have as much capacitance as a telephone. So what is the approximate capacitance of a telephone, Al? K6DPZ, K2LAW?
Derek, I'll tell you, it's been a long time, so I can't give you an honest answer on that. But I'll tell you one thing, I used to run phantom circuits on a pair of wires to get two separate audios over one phone line.
They were saying that they measured capacitance. I'm going to guess they're really measuring inductance of the ringer circuit. That 90 volts at 20 hertz that runs the ringer, that's really going into a solenoid coil. So I'm thinking they're really measuring inductance, and you again fox them with a pair of diodes. Very crafty idea. Hey, Hal, if you wanted to put 3 or 4 phone circuits in the house, diodes might not be enough. Then it's time to use some kind of an intermediate amplifier, so to speak, so that the line is lightly loaded, but each telephone still gets a full signal. So did you, out of curiosity, have a crafty technique by which you could put 4 telephones in the same house? K6DPZ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Matter of fact, I did. Knock off all the ringers, pick this ringing signal off the line, amplify it, and just got a bunch of speakers.
Yeah, most people's residence is small enough that if any one of the phones ring in the center of the house, the fact that the others don't ring is not much of a disadvantage. I personally also did that. One phone in the middle of the house would ring, and the ringer circuits were disconnected from the other phones. So we all had ways of foxing the system. We shouldn't be revealing this. John, look what you're getting us to all admit. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yep, fun stuff. Well, if you remember, Dick, when phones were being sold by private companies after the breakup, there were marks on the phone called equivalent ringers, and they had to meet the specs so that they could check those things. But if you go way back to the day when I was young, if you remember, you had your phone on the desk and the ringer was on the baseboard, and have that as the bell box, it was called, and that would ring. And you could put as many phones as you wanted to that was not detectable, and you could hear the box ring throughout the house. So you're absolutely right. If the ringer is disconnected, they can't tell how many phones are on the line. Very good. I'll drop this and go on to my next. Okay. Now this gentleman's got a clever idea he's working with. That two directional couplers opposed, source and the forward signal at the same time, they're 10 dB. What he's doing with this, looking at FM transmissions, and he's monitoring it on an XY function on an oscilloscope. So he can now have a location on the oscilloscope where he can mark and then get his row numbers and figure out the SWR. He hasn't built it yet. He's in the process of building it. He'd like to know what you think of that and opinion. Also, I have an issue with, I don't think it's going to work well in AM or single sideband and let alone generator to determine WR. FM, I think you can get away with it. What's your thoughts on it, Dick? KC2WGB, back to you.
Hal's going to be a little bit disappointed with me because this could turn into a fairly long discussion. Make believe that I told people I'm going to give a talk on directional couplers tonight. I just happen to be answering somebody's question on directional couplers. Directional couplers are something we amateurs, from our usual experience in the books we read and the courses that we take, have very little knowledge of directional couplers. And that is a sad state of affairs. The closest we come to having directional coupler knowledge is that some of the ways that we can homebrew a standing wave ratio bridge really is a pair of directional couplers. Most of the designs really are a pair of directional couplers. That mono match, I think, is the thing, or mini match, the one where you stick a piece of enameled wire underneath the braid of a coaxial cable, and then by properly hooking both ends of that wire into the right kind of a diode and resistor network with a switch, you can measure forward power, reverse power, look at the ratio between the two, and interpret that as standing wave ratio. Let me drop. Most people call that a standing wave ratio bridge. That really is a very simple, very sophisticated, dual directional coupler. That one piece of enameled wire under the braid is a dual directional coupler. It is capable of differentiating the signal that flows forward and measuring that out of one end of the wire and the signal that flows back out of the other end of the wire. As long as the wire is properly terminated on each end and has the right kind of a diode rectifier on each end. Directional couplers are extremely simple in physical layout in many circumstances. The understanding of how in the world the signal could be sensed in one direction and ignored in the other direction at one end of that wire, how that really comes about, is a little bit complicated. Take my word for it. Let me drop. So real standing wave ratio is measured most of the time with something that looks like a dual directional coupler. I'll admit there's a way of doing it with something that looks like a Wheatstone bridge. And there it's a little bit less obvious as to what's taking place. It's not a directional coupler anymore. But many of the Biswar standing wave ratio detecting circuits are a directional coupler. What you care about most is the ratio of forward voltage to the ratio of the reverse forward, ratio of forward over reverse. I should say reverse over forward. That is what standing wave ratio really is. So if you're using a pair of directional couplers, a physical device, a three-port device, and you're hooking up a pair of them in series, where the straight-through line is in series, and you're looking at the forward directional line and the reverse directional line, and one might be a 10 dB coupler and one might be a 20 dB coupler, you might have to do a little bit of adjustment because of the coupling coefficient. That's a minor detail. And now if you take those two signals and display it into a pair of oscilloscope circuits. If you've got a dual channel oscilloscope and the forward voltage is put into channel number one and the reverse voltage is put into channel number two and you've got these two traces on the screen and you look at the ratio between those two traces, no matter what the signal is, whether it's amplitude modulated, Morse code, single sideband or whatever, by looking at the ratio of those two traces, you are displaying standing wave ratio. To hook one up into the X port and one into the Y port, whatever the oscilloscope, that's going to give you an interpretation that's a little more difficult to deal with, depending on whether or not you've rectified those voltages or you're looking at the Ruhr RF. In the case of a fast oscilloscope with two channels, or an oscilloscope where you put in an external switching network, let me drop this. Back in the old days, we used to take a single-channel oscilloscope and make it act like two channels by having a fast chopping circuit, a switching circuit. You really got two sources of signal, and you got a single-pole, double-throw switch, which can be electronic, it can be mechanical, and you flip back and forth between the two. And as long as you get the synchronization correct on the oscilloscope, you now can figure out which channel. You can end up with two traces on the screen, even though there's only one channel to that oscilloscope. So by various means, you can have two channels. But by comparing the ratio between the forward and reverse signal, that is the raw data that gives you standing wave ratio. Now, how you calibrate those directional couplers, how you measure their directivity, how you confirm their directivity, there's a whole test procedure on that. And there's a beautiful, I shouldn't say beautiful, there is an article that a lot of people have said very positive words about, printed by a guy called K2RIW, way back in the dark ages of 2002, and it's available to you. It's on the internet. Let me drop it. If you go to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and that's that beautiful website by Jay Perry, KC2NJI, and there's a similar website by Mike and Mike, Mike number one, Mike number two. Mike number two has also got a very nice website called limarktechnet.com. In either case, you're going to get a lot of information. But I know for a fact that the first one, amateurradio.tangovictor, you go to that website, not only can you look at, listen to all the past recordings of the TechNet, the last 10 years worth of them are there, but there's also a section where technical articles by K2RIW are there, and one of those technical articles tells you how to use directional couplers for power measurement and standing wave ratio measurement. Let me drop the couple. The article contains about 1,000 words explaining what is in almost no amateur radio books. It's almost in none of the textbooks you use in college, and yet it contains very useful information with the rules of thumb that the guys really in the field are using, if you know what I mean. It tells you how to use various directional couplers far outside of their frequency region. That directional coupler made by Nada that sits on the table at a flea market, where it originally cost $2,000 or something like that, and it's sitting there for $10, $15 being sold in the surplus market. And it's got a rating on it from 500 to 1,000 megs. And that's not your frequency range. You want to know what's happening at 2 meters, 6 meters, 80 meters, and you would say, gee, that's way outside of my frequency range. I can't use it. Not true. That article, it'll tell you how to take that directional coupler that's way outside of the frequency range you care about, how to properly calibrate it, how to properly use it, how to get useful information out of it, and a little bit about how it works is in that article at amateurradio.tangovictor. So directional couplers, it's an extremely good thing to make an investment in because it is such a simple tool. It's purely passive. It sucks essentially none of the energy that you're using. It samples a little bit of the signal flowing down your transmission line and gives you some extremely valuable information you want to know about. If, for instance, the wind blew your antenna and created some damage to it. Now your antenna has jumped to a brand new standing wave ratio. By way of the directional couplers you have sitting in the line there 24 hours a day, so to speak, you would know it immediately. You know why your transmitter is now acting crazy. So to monitor standing wave ratio is a very handy thing. It tells you whether or not your transmission line system and antenna is working correctly. It's the poor man's equivalent of a scalar network analyzer. A pair of directional couplers is the heart of the system of a scalar network analyzer. The only thing that's different about a scalar network analyzer, it has a forward directional coupler and a reverse directional coupler. The only thing different is that in most cases it has a frequency synthesizer that can sweep across the frequency region while it's doing those measurements. By way of your ham radio transmitter, you can't sweep quite as fast, but you can make the measurement on every band you care about where you've got the capability of transmitting more than a few milliwatts a power. So, directional couplers, we shouldn't shy away from them. We should learn what they are, and on top of that, in the worst case situation, or the best case situation, if you've got a transmitter and you want to be able to sample the power output of that transmitter and sample the power coming back to that transmitter, for you to put a simple loop of wire near the center conductor of the coaxial cable going from the main circuitry of your transmitter and going to the output connector on the back panel, you to sneak a little piece of wire in there by which you can sample the power going out of your transmitter and therefore bring it into the front panel if you like, a separate circuit if you like, to directionally sample the power coming out of your transmitter and coming back to your transmitter. For you to add that circuit to a transmitter that you've got, let me drop it. It would cost you about $1 worth of components. The most expensive thing would be the meter that gives you the display and the switch that allows you to switch between forward and reverse. Or maybe you're going to use a pair of meters, one who's continuously looking at forward power and one who's continuously looking at reverse power. For a few dollars of investment, let me drop it. A few dollars worth of investment, with you sneaking a piece of wire near your transmitter power output connector, would allow you to do directional sensing, because most of our transmitters run tens of watts, hundreds of watts, and you only need milliwatts of power. So the amount of signal that you're sucking up with this simple little sampling circuit is so small, the transmitter will never know the difference. You can get some very valuable information out of it. So directional couplers are something that are one-third as important as antennas from my point of view. It's an area where we amateurs tend to know very little, and we can get a lot of benefit out of them. So what this guy is doing with a pair of directional couplers, he's going down the right path. Give him encouragement, John, and after he runs these experiments, please have him come back to us and tell us what he found. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun with this, Dick. It's a great idea, because with that ratio detection that he can do with the two reverse couplers and going into his XY function on the scope, it's going to give him a dot on the scope which will move around as the SWR changes. So I think he's going to be able to do real-time monitoring as he plays. I think it's a crafty idea. I wish him a lot of luck with that. He's using two, I recommended that he picked up a couple of these HP diodes that thread right on. They have end connectors on them, detector diodes, and they work very well with the couplers. Rather than try to build the diode, he can get them for about $30 each. So very good. I'm sure he's going to have a ball with this. And he can even put a lens on his scope and make his marks and do things like that, calculate the row and figure out all his positions. So I'm sure he'll have a ball.
Let me add some words to this. I'm waiting for the beep. I'm suddenly thinking a little bit more about using the XY function of a good oscilloscope. In reality, he's going to get a dot in the center of the screen if he's getting no voltage. As he starts getting forward voltage, let's say that becomes the X deflection. As he gets a good reverse voltage, he's getting some amount of voltage, he's going to be getting Y deflection. And now, if in the worst case, he had a extremely high standing wave ratio transmission line antenna, such that the reverse power and the forward power are almost the same, that means the amount of deflection he gets in X and the amount of deflection he gets in Y are going to be equal, and this is a kind of polar diagram that's going to be drawing a 45 degree line on that oscilloscope screen. If his oscilloscope happened to be fast enough that he's looking at the raw RF voltage and not looking at the detected voltage out of the diode, but he's got two choices on this one, but if he's looking at the raw RF voltage, it would be making, in the worst case, a slant 45-degree line going up to the right and down to the lower left if it's RF voltage being displayed. The tilt of that line, this is really a kind of polar display, the tilt of that line is the standing wave ratio. And so whether, no matter what kind of modulation he's got, he's going to be drawing a line, and if he had very little standing wave ratio, the line is going to be purely horizontal. If he's got extremely high standing wave ratio, the line is going to be a 45-degree line. In between, with his grease pencil, if he wanted to, he could draw a whole bunch of lines that represent the different kinds of standing wave ratio. And if he wants to, he can make the sensitivity of the Y channel higher than the sensitivity of the X channel, which happens to be the way most oscilloscopes work naturally. Let me drop. Therefore, in the worst-case situation of a very high standing wave ratio, it wouldn't even be a 45-degree line. It'd be a 60 or 75-degree line from horizontal. And so he can get great sensitivity with all kinds of modulation techniques. It doesn't matter. The slope of the line is the standing wave ratio once you properly calibrate it. I wonder if you see the operation here. He's ahead of us on this one, John. He is really making a polar display using the X and Y function. And it sure would be nice if his scope was fast enough that it could tolerate the RF in both the X channel and the Y channel. That properly deployed into a handheld device would be a beautiful piece of test equipment. Think about that one, John. KC2WGB, that's a new product. K2LIW on the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Yeah, Dick, that's the way I feel about it. I think he's onto something that can be useful, and maybe he will develop a product. But also, my problem is if he tries to go to single sideband with audio, I think that that'll be jumping all over the screen, and it won't be much useful information unless he used a steady tone. That's just my first impression. What do you think?
At first, I thought that also, John. Let's assume now that the oscilloscope happens to be fast enough in the X and Y channel that it can look at the raw RF. And whether you're transmitting single sideband, Morse code, amplitude modulation, key down, steady state, whatever, the instantaneous magnitude of the RF voltage coming out of your transmitter is going to give you a certain amount of X deflection. The standing wave ratio is going to give you a certain amount of Y deflection, because a steady state standing wave ratio means that the ratio of forward voltage and the ratio of reverse voltage are always that ratio. Therefore, even though the dot you think is dancing all over the screen, the dot, the X deflection and the Y deflection always have that fixed ratio, which is the standing wave ratio. Therefore, it's going to be tracing a line, a simple line, at the 45 degree angle. If you've got equal amplitude of horizontal and vertical, in the word, in our particular example, equal directional couplers, and extremely high standing wave ratio, that line is going to be dancing back and forth from the center dot up to the right and from the center dot down to the right. The magnitude of deflection from the dot is going to be changing with the instantaneous amplitude, but in all cases, the ratio stays the same. In all cases, the line keeps the exact same slope. Do you see the beauty of that, John? The slope of the line is the standing wave ratio, and he's going to be instantaneously displaying the ratio of forward to reverse, which is the ratio of X to Y, which is the slope of that line. Doesn't matter what modulation he's got. And we've got one other beauty of this thing. Let me drop this. If he happens to be measuring the standing wave ratio between his driver and his final stage of his transmitter, and the final stage of the transmitter is, let's assume it's a transistorized final, that beyond a certain amount of drive, the final stage saturates and the input impedance changes. That line, which is going to be a straight 45-degree line with high standing wave ratio, is suddenly going to tilt over at the ends. The tips will tilt if the transmitter goes in, if the stage that he's driving goes into saturation. So he can simultaneously display interstage standing wave ratio. He can simultaneously see saturation characteristics of the thing that he's driving. If the antenna had an arc over, or if the transmitter is, if the driver is going into a transmitter which saturates, he will be able to see that by the sudden slope change at the tip of that line. That is a beautiful piece of test equipment he's designing, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW TechNet. Keep tracking on this guy.
Comment?
Comment, go ahead.
I think, wouldn't it be the possibility, though, that if you put it on where the antenna feed is, that the reflected voltage could be some different phase relationship with the forward, and instead of getting a slant line, you could get a circle or some kind of ellipse? Go ahead.
I think that was John, and you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. There is going to be a time delay. At a low enough frequency, what I said would be true. Therefore, if he's doing it in a rectified manner, now, if he's got an RF rectifying circuit, which is fast compared to slow compared to the RF, but fast compared to the audio. So now, single sideband audio will again draw that 45 degree line. With the rectifier, it's only going to be going up to the right. It's not going to go down to the lower left. You're right, there will be a phase shift. By rectifying with a rectifier circuit that's got a time constant that is long compared to the RF frequency, but short compared to the audio frequency, he's still going to draw that line. Now the phase shift doesn't matter. What do you think about that? I think this is John, W2VDH, and thank you for bringing that to our attention, K2RIW and the TechNet. Who was that person who had the comment?
Oh, Oh, yes, yeah, I'm sorry, that's WA2VDH. Fine business, Dick, fine business. Go ahead.
Now, this test equipment has got one further trick up its sleeve. By using the rectifier network for the forward diode, for the forward RF, and the rectifier network for the reverse RF, and that's going into the X channel and the Y channel of the oscilloscope, now with this rectifier network with the right time constant, he's drawing a straight line that has a particular slope, and the slope tells you the standing wave ratio, and the line taking a sudden hook at the upper end tells you the stage he's driving is going into saturation. I'll give you a hint to that. If he now flips back to the pure RF display with the phase shift, I think there's ways of interpreting that screen. It's now going to be drawing a kind of an ellipse, and the phase shift between the X and the Y really is a lizardry pattern. Now the ellipticity ratio and the major axis and minor axis orientation of the lizardry pattern is now telling you the exact phase shift between the transmitting signal and the received signal. That's telling you something about how many wavelengths of transmission line. I mean, the vertical deflection is still defining standing wave ratio. But now that ellipse that you draw is giving you another piece of information. It's now going one step beyond a scalar network analyzer, which only displays amplitude. You're now starting to display phase. Proper interpretation of that screen is going to give you the phase angle, and you're moving toward a vector network analyzer. It's going to take a little more interpretation, but the data is there. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet, we're slowly developing a new piece of test equipment here, John.
KC2WGB, yes, I believe so, Dick. Also, if he has something similar to the 7401 Tektronix, where he can have more inputs, use it as a dual XY, and he can watch the RF through a T and the DC rectified, both going into two XY monitors, and he would be able to see exactly what you're talking about. A lot of stuff could be done with this. Fascinating.
Yeah, in the old days, electronic engineers as well as ham radio operators, the word RF phase angle would scare the living daylights out of them. When Hewlett-Packard first started coming along with a vector network analyzer, piece of instrumentation that would measure phase and measure amplitude simultaneously and properly display it, we thought it was a huge breakthrough to be able to measure RF phase. The vector voltmeter was one of the first products that Hewlett-Packard came out with. I think it was in the time frame of around 1975 or so. The vector voltmeter. You own one of those. In fact, you've owned so darn many of them that one of them didn't work well and you threw it away. So you've got vector voltmeters to throw away, John. But when that first came out, that thing goes down to 1 megahertz and up to 1 gigahertz. So between 1 meg and 1 gigahertz, that thing had a kind of a phase lock loop to it, and it would measure phase angle to the nearest fraction of a degree, 0 to 360 degrees, plus and minus, as well as measuring amplitude ratios with huge dynamic range. That Hewlett-Packard vector voltmeter was a real beauty. But by way of an oscilloscope with directional couplers, with either direct RF detection and or diode detection, we can do some of that function. To measure the exact phase angle by this technique is, I'll admit, a little bit difficult. However, to be able to see by the lizardry pattern where the major axis, minor axis of the ellipse is concerned, that's giving you phase information, time delay information, all kinds of ways of looking at it. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet. Phase is not that mysterious.
2QIQ with a question.
Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beeps.
Combination at the end to peak detect. How is the phase, and it's kind of a question, I'm missing something. In fact, you said K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You said peak detect, and now the word peak detect has got two meanings. It can be peak detecting the RF, that's good. But do you want to peak detect the audio? I say no. Let's assume now that the audio is going to go from 0 to 1 kilohertz. And let's assume that the RF is running at, let me pick a number, 10 megahertz. If I set up a rectifier network with an RC constant to it, such that it responds very fast to the RF, but no, I wanted to rectify the RF at every instant, but I want the time constant to be fast compared to the audio. I want the time constant to be able to look at a 1 kHz audio, whether it be sideband or AM, doesn't matter, and I want the instantaneous amplitude to be displayed as the output of that rectifier. So I'm making the rectifier RC time constant fast compared to the audio. Now the audio is jumping up and down on the X axis, the audio is jumping up and down on the Y axis. It is drawing a 45 degree line in the worst case situation. And so each cycle of the audio is making that dot sweep along that 45 degree line. And you see what I'm saying here? So I'm not peak detecting the audio. Peak detecting the RF, yes. I want the audio after rectification to come through on the X and the Y channel. Now you're drawing that line, and the slope of that line is standing wave ratio. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
So I guess what you're saying in a sense is that because it's on an XY scanner, I got to think about this one on the scope, that you're going to be detecting still, in other words, still the diode. You have a rectification angle of 90 degrees, because you know, you're chopping off the 180 from the other side. And so, in other words, the peak is still going to be accurate. But I'm still losing something. In other words, how do you still maintain, with rectification, the phase angle on an XY display? Because, in other words, you're going to have, through one port coming through, it's going to be forward, and one is going to be the reverse, and you're going to be comparing. There's still phase information in there. That's kind of what I'm wondering. KC2QIQ.
RF wise, there is phase information. After a diode rectifier, Glenn, the RF phase is thoroughly wiped out. The rectifier for the forward and the rectifier for the reverse is only looking at peak RF at that audio instant. If I'm putting in a slow sine wave of audio, that's making the amplitude going up and down. And whether it's an AM transmitter or a sideband transmitter, almost doesn't matter. The audio is going up and down in amplitude. That means the RF is going up and down in amplitude. That means I am sweeping in X and I'm sweeping in Y during the audio cycle. So the peak RF during that instant is being displayed in X and Y. The fact that the RF has a phase angle doesn't matter, because the rectifier is rectifying the peak of RF, but the audio relationship, in other words, the dot is walking up and down in a 45 degree line as I'm going through the various amplitudes of the RF with the amplitude modulation. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. I'm right on with you. I think we're seeing the same thing. It's just I was getting a little mixed up with terms. But I think what you're saying is the same thing that I'm saying. That we're seeing the amplitude during the amplitude cycles, and we're comparing the forward with the reflected, and we're looking at that display difference at that point. But that's difference in amplitude, correct? And what threw me off before was when we were saying phase, but we're really just talking about the differences of the amplitude in a vector that's going to give us a representation of the SWR. But back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The instantaneous amplitude of the transmitter going up and down, whether it be sideband or AM modulated or CW modulated, almost doesn't matter. As the amplitude goes up and down, the rectified RF is sweeping you horizontally for forward. The rectified RF is sweeping you vertically. The ratio of vertical to horizontal gives you a certain slope of that line. So the dot is being swept from the center of the screen to the upper right-hand corner, so to speak. But that line, you're seeing the line trace out the various amplitudes each millisecond, so to speak, or each 10 microseconds of the audio. So you're following the instantaneous RF amplitude, displaying the ratio as a slope of that line on the screen. Yes, the dot will be a little bit brighter at the tip, because with normal amplitude modulation, you dwell a little bit longer at the positive peak, so to speak, and negative peak of the audio. And this thing doesn't know the difference between the two, so to speak. That's true for sideband. Now, that would be true for double sideband. But the slope of the line that's traced is what is telling telling you standing wave ratio when you're using rectification. I'll admit that when you're displaying complete RF, ROR RF in horizontal and ROR RF in vertical, you're now drawing a kind of a lizard you pattern. The interpretation is a little bit more difficult, but still the raw data is there. If you're smart enough, it is telling you not only standing wave ratio, it's telling you, let me drop quick, telling you the phase angle between the two, which is telling you something about, if you know the number of wavelengths of your transmission line, you now have a poor man's vector network analyzer. Once you know the number of wavelengths of your transmission line, and you know the residue pattern you're drawing on that screen, and where's the major axis and minor axis, and the slope of that of the semi-major axis, slope again is going to be telling you standing wave ratio, and the semi-major and semi-minor axis ratio is going to be telling you phase angle, and that can tell you whether or not your antenna is inductive or capacitive, in my opinion. I didn't say it's easy, but the raw data is there. What if you have any further comments on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Vic. We're definitely on the same page on this one for sure. And, yeah, I think actually, you know, probably some very, very fast video amplifiers were used. You could probably even calibrate it and, you know, kind of use like differential inputs and other things, come up with a circuit that could probably simplify that a bit. Yeah, very interesting conversation, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
All my experience has told me that many engineers and most ham radio operators, when somebody starts discussing phase angle of RF, it scares them. They think it's black magic, and until Hewlett-Packard came along with their vector voltmeter in roughly 1975, we used to think that phase angle measurement is out of the question. And nowadays, you can buy many, two or three different brand names of phase measuring equipment, which is called Vector Network Analyzer. You can buy a couple of brands that go to 110 gigahertz. Can you imagine measuring the phase angle of a signal at 110 gigahertz? Say those words 20 years ago, and people would say you're crazy. They're now doing it. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
The technique is not totally new.
Oh, there's a guy who is doing it and keeping it under his hat. Am I hearing, this sounds like Vito. Is that Vito?
Oh, it says K2GJE.
Ed, give us a couple of words on that. At what point in time measuring RF phase angle? Go ahead, Ed.
K2RIW, K2. This was a technique used by Technical Material Corporation to adjust the linearity of a transmitter that, I don't know if you'd call it single sideband, it really was double sideband, no carrier, where there was different information on each sideband and also channels on each sideband. It was very important that the final amplifier run linear, and they detected the RF coming into the grid and the RF at the plate. Over.
Fantastic. Yeah, the TMC company was building some very high-class stuff in the late 60s, for instance. And sounds like you worked for that company, Ed. And what year were you making those simultaneous amplitude and or phase measurements of grid versus plate to measure linearity? What year were you doing that? By the way, was that a so-called butterfly display on an oscilloscope screen? And what happened to the TMC company? A fantastic company in its day. It was the local Collins radio, to my knowledge. K2GJE, K2LAW, you got it, Ed. Wait for the beep.
Okay. No, I unfortunately that wasn't one of my jobs. I did work for Hazeldine, which also doesn't exist. I don't know what happened to TMC. They got a line, and it was very important there be no crooked tail at the beginning of the line and and the end of the line, and they would adjust the transmitter for a straight line. And these transmitters, I know some of them were sold to RCA. That probably, well, RCA ended their operation out there in Rocky Point, I think in the early 70s. So it must have been sold to them in the 60s, over.
That RCA installation was, I think, at Riverhead, if that's the one you're talking about. And that great big 130-foot tower out in Riverhead, you may know that I purchased that tower and started taking it apart and took the 28-foot dish off of it. So by way of this monitoring of grid voltage and plate voltage and displaying it on an oscilloscope to measure linearity, the beginning of the line you want it to be straight, which I think represented crossover distortion. The end of the line you want it to be straight, which represents plate saturation. Is that approximately what you were doing? And roughly what year were you doing this, Ed? K2GJE? K2LIW in the TechNet?
This was in the 60s. Well, in part of the 60s, I was in the service. I can't tell you exactly what I was doing and where I was doing it. This was in the 60s, and the technique works, and they used a very, believe it or not, a very small cathode ray tube, and it was very easy to make these adjustments. That's why I was listening to you, and this was a technique that TMC evidently came up with. Sometime when you have a moment, I have an SWR bridge that uses the Wheatstone principle. Of course, there's like the input is on one leg, the antenna is on one leg, a dummy load is a third leg, and I think some other resistors on the fourth leg, over.
The other technique of measuring standing wave ratio, not using a pair of directional couplers, is the Wheatstone bridge. And the Wheatstone bridge is looking for a pure resistive load. The Wheatstone bridge really has four resistors. And those four resistors are set up in a diamond pattern. They're all in series, so to speak, but it's a diamond pattern. And you could say between the 6 o'clock and 12 o'clock point, you put in the signal generator. Between the 3 o'clock point and the 9 o'clock point, you put the output sensor device, and now if those four resistors are equal to each other, the thing is thoroughly balanced. By that I mean none of the signal generator from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock appears across the resistors between 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and the four resistors are equal to each other. Let me drop. And let's assume that you make all four of those resistors 50 ohm low inductance resistors, high quality 50 ohm resistors, all four. And now you unplug one of those resistors, doesn't matter which one, and you plug in your unknown 50 ohm transmission line for the fourth resistor. If that transmission line gives you exactly 50 ohms, you'll get a perfect balance of that bridge, and you'll get no output indication. And as that fourth resistor, which is your transmission line, goes up and down in impedance, or becomes a phase shift of reactance, inductive or capacitive, you're now not getting a Wheatstone bridge that's balanced throughout the whole RF cycle. Therefore, you'll start detecting voltage between 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and now the magnitude of that voltage is telling you the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. So a Wheatstone bridge is another valuable technique for doing these kind of measurements. And there, it's not quite a directional coupler, so to speak. It's really it's a balanced network looking for a pure 50 ohm resistor, and anything higher or lower in resistance will unbalance it. Anything in phase shift of capacitive or inductive reactance will unbalance it. And now the detector will see something, and the detector is telling you what the standing wave ratio is. And by the way, did that small oscilloscope, was that mounted on the front panel of the transmitter so you could monitor the quality of the transmitter while you're using it? Did the TMC product do it that way yet, Ed? K2GJE, K2LAW in the TechNet.
TechNet, Limar, K2GJE. front panel. Very beautifully made. Thank you for the information on the Wheatstone Bridge. What happens here on the one that I have, when you set it, I believe it's using the 50-ohm dummy load, and then which you bring to full scale, and then when you put it on the position to make a measure, you get...